Wolf, get away from those sheep.
Bollocks.
You're listening to the Wolf and the Shepherd podcast, broadcasting from Fort Worth in the great state of Texas. Now, get ready for this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd.
Welcome to this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd. Today we have with us Bill Small. Bill, glad you could join us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Hey, Bill, I'm going to go in reverse here a little bit because you're just starting a new podcast, right?
Yes.
Right. Well, I think you've misnamed it to begin with, because why you didn't call it The Adventures of Little Bill, I don't know. It was too obvious. It was staring you right in the face and you went for something completely different.
That's true. I did.
Yeah.
I did.
Well, and we kept calling you like Little Bill or Small Bill or whatever. And I said, we got to stop that because it came in on our email with your last name first. So it said Small Bill. And I'm like, okay, so, you know, at 3 o'clock today, we got Small Bill. And he's like, yeah, Small Bill and all this. I'm like, we got to stop saying that because we're just going to call him Small Bill throughout the whole podcast. And I'm sure you've heard that over and over again.
It's going to make me feel like I'm in fourth grade again.
Right. Yeah. Well, I figured I'd just better get it out of the way up front.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
So your new podcast, The Subtle Art of Not Yelling. Can you tell us about that before we go into everything else behind you?
Yeah, absolutely. Through no fault of my own, I've had a lot of experience with internet marketing over the last 15, almost 20 years. And mostly I hate it. I've quit more times than you can possibly imagine. I have talked perfectly normal business people out of staying the hell away from it. And at the same time, I always find myself drawn to it again, mostly for, you know, business reasons. It's a viable way to grow your business. And I met my podcasting partner, Miles Hansen, last year, and we started talking about marketing and realized initially that we think about it the same way and that all the things that I don't like about it are the same things he doesn't like about it. And this is what he actually does for a living. And we did a little work together and it was really good for me and we had a lot of conversations. And then we thought, you know, listen, these conversations are really good. Maybe somebody else would want to hear them. I had kind of wanted to start a podcast. He had kind of wanted to start a podcast. But the last thing I wanted to do was sit in front of a microphone by myself and blah, 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 blah. So just like you guys, having a partner in it just made it a whole lot more fun. So we started in September. And I think we are about to release episode 10. So it's been a lot of fun.
Cool. Now, I have a little bit of a background in marketing in that my first degree was in marketing, but this was before the age of the internet, really, or at least for us peasants. And I hated marketing, to be honest with you, when it came into practice, because regardless of what they told you, it was the three pillars of sex, controversy, and dogs. Those were the things which sold the majority of products.
Dogs?
Yeah. You're dogs. Always going to get somebody's attention with a dog in an advert, whether it be on TV or
But the sex part, I understand that, right?
Well,
and the controversy. Yeah.
If you can combine some of those, if not all of them, you've kind of hit the golden nugget there.
Well, if you combine sex and dogs, isn't that controversial? So you go all the way around, you get all three?
Depends how you do it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So what's your podcast about in a nutshell? I mean, does it go from week to week just addressing things which come on the scene with your topic, or is this something you've got like planned out to try and reach this goal of communicating something?
We don't plan a thing. I mean, nothing. Not anything.
So we do our production.
Line common.
Basically, we have the same production team, it sounds like. Yeah.
Exactly. Our producer is sitting at the end of the table here.
Yes. Yeah. You know, we have a basic premise that we talk about growing a business. We talk about mindset. We talk about marketing. We have guests on who are interesting. You know, maybe they have... I'm always drawn to people who are solopreneurs, entrepreneurs, have small businesses. So many people in the music space that I'm a part of you know, they're business people. They don't always know that, but they are. So it's really interesting to get those kind of perspectives. We just did an episode with someone who just released his first novel. And I'd never really talked to anybody about that. And, from the process of actually getting it done to, okay, great, you wrote a novel. Now what? You know, what are you going to do now? And just all the things that happen. So we really, kind of like you guys, we have an interesting guest. We have some idea of what we might want to ask that person, and then we go wherever we go.
Nice. Now, it kind of reminded me, you know, when you write the book, I think that's the easiest part of the whole journey, so to speak, because once you get the book done, then you got to market it and sell it and all that, and that's probably harder than actually writing the book for, you know, most authors out there.
And from what I understand, if you really want to be a working author, you have to write it, sell it, and be writing another one.
Right.
Pretty much all the time.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. So tell us a little bit, since, you know, we're all from Texas here, and we don't normally get to talk to a fellow Texan all that often. Tell us a little bit about Wimberley, Texas.
Yeah, so Wimberley is a little town about 35 miles southwest of Austin on the Blanco River, mostly known as a little river vacation spot. And when I moved to Austin in 1990, Wimberley was the place where, that's where all the hippies moved. You know, if they wanted to get out of town, Austin was getting too big, they'd come out here. It's not exactly that anymore, but, you know, is anywhere. It's grown quite a bit, but it's still small, and it's beautiful. It really is one of the prettiest places that in Texas that I know, and I've been to a lot of places in Texas.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I hadn't heard of it, and the Shepherd hadn't either. And it amazes my relatives back home when I say there's places in my state I haven't heard of or haven't been to, because they have no kind of relativity in terms of how big Texas is. And when I say, well, you can fit six lots of England and Scotland in Texas, and that kind of opens their eyes a little bit. But, you know, they're still grasping the fact that sometimes when I go like hiking, I have to take a gun or a knife to protect myself against bears, mountain lions, snakes, and gators. And, you know, the best they see is like a stray dog with an attitude issue. Now, down there, is it pretty quiet? Cause, I mean, I know Austin is obviously a hotbed of activity for everything with the arts. Is that kind of why you stayed down there as a little satellite orbiting Austin?
Yeah, absolutely. And we had tried to buy a home in Austin, and that was impossible. So we ended up finding something out here about 8 years ago, and it seemed like a good place to be. I have a 10-year-old, so it's a good place to have a kid. It's funny you mentioned the size of the state. My brother-in-law is from the UK. And when we first met, I was still living in the Northeast. I was living in New Jersey. And he and my sister were together. Our parents were living in Chicago. So the first Christmas that he came home with us, we drove him from New Jersey to Chicago. And about halfway through Pennsylvania, he got really weird. I'm like, Mark, what's wrong? He said, well, we would have fallen off of England an hour ago. We should be in the ocean right now. He had never been in a car that long in his life.
Yeah, and of course, the ongoing joke with Texas is Houston is an hour away from Houston. You know, because the traffic is getting so bad with, you know, everybody moving here now. And I'm sure you're seeing a lot of it down in the Austin area. I mean, up here, it's crazy. So being a business coach and getting into that field, how did that start up for you? What kind of inspired you to become a business coach?
Yeah, it's funny. In the 90s, I got trained as a coach, doing like some personal development kind of seminars and things like that. But that wasn't a thing. I didn't know that was a job that people had. And I had worked as a vocal coach for a while, which in some ways wasn't dissimilar. If you think about it, if you are teaching someone to play piano, it's pretty easy to see if they're doing something wrong. You know, I'll move your finger over here, right? With the voice, you can't really see it all that well. Right. It, so much of it is what's going on in your head. And in 2008, I had spent a year and a half with this band that I ended up being in for 16 years, Walt Wilkins and the Mysticaros. We just put our first record out. We traveled all over the place. I was cold, tired, hungry, and broke, and looking for something to do. And a friend of mine, who was a filmmaker and also a really great coach, had just gotten a job coaching people. I said, wait a minute, man, you're getting paid to do that? He said, yeah. And I hung up the phone. And then I thought, wait a minute, did he say he was getting paid to do that? So I called him back. I said, hey, are they hiring? As a matter of fact. So at that time in 2008, there was a company in Austin that was providing coaches for some authors who had been featured in a movie and a book called The Secret. This guy named Joe Vitale and Bob Doyle, they both had books that lots of people read, and those books helped a lot of people. People wanted more, but they can't, you know, it's one guy. He couldn't coach a whole bunch of people. So I was one of the coaches in those coaching programs. That was 2008. So by mid-2009, nobody was paying for coaching programs anymore, right? Economy kind of went right into the you-know-whater. And but I had found that I not only had an aptitude for it, I'd been trained well, I really liked it, but like I really liked it. As much as I like playing music, I was able to have, you have a conversation with somebody that actually makes a difference for them. And I could get paid for that, really? And then over the course of a couple of years of doing it, I noticed that the most fun that I had was with people who were in business, who were either entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, had a small business of some kind. Because I tell you what, everything they go through is everything I've gone through as a musician forever. And, you know, the only thing that's really in their way ever is themselves. And the one thing I've become good at is helping people get out of their own way.
Yeah, I was a business analyst for most of the 90s, and I started off with no experience whatsoever, but I realized about 10 minutes into it, you really didn't need that much experience, just common sense and being able to problem solve and especially reverse engineer. And I found that the biggest issue with businesses was a lack of people with common sense in the decision-making positions. And you know, it became very popular towards the end of the 90s to do all this group think stuff. You know, let's all sit down and, you know, have a discussion and hope one of us grows an extra brain cell to come up with an original thought. But, you know, I think where business has kind of hit a brick wall is because there's too much information. There's information saturation. I think the books around at the time and, you know, the more popular keynote speakers were very competent. The information you got was pretty valuable. Now, probably 98% of the information you get is crap, especially, you know, with the dawn of the internet and everybody offering you a program. Yes. Did you see from when you first started that your job became easier because you didn't have to be quite so good at it as time went on with all the starters coming up? Or did you find it more difficult because it switched away from the old traditional kind of coaching and enforcement methods in business to this entire new playing field where nobody still really has a clue which direction it's going to go?
You know, it's interesting. I'm not sure that for me it was easier or harder. I think one of the key things about what my role becomes with a business owner is you made this really great point about kind of poor decision making, right? People just not making great decisions. And part of the reason is you own your own business. You're trying to figure out what to do. Who do you talk to about that? Who do you talk to that doesn't have an agenda or doesn't have skin in the game in some way? If you have a partner, it can be difficult to talk to a partner depending on the issue. You certainly can't talk to your employees, and don't bring it home. Your spouse doesn't want to hear that. So to a large extent, what I become is a trusted advisor, just someone that, you know, you own a business, you got a lot of stuff to deal with. So let's work through that stuff from a common sense perspective, you know, before you go off mad or upset or scared and make a decision that could tank your whole thing.
So how much of your musical background and like creating songs and things like that do you think probably played a part into your approach of the business coach?
I think that a conversation is just as creative as a musical performance or writing a song or anything else. There's an ability to just kind of be in the moment. And I think that's maybe one of the things that gets missing, not only from the business owner perspective, people who don't necessarily know how to just be in this moment, because there's so much to worry about and so much to think about and so much information flying at them all the time. And also from a coaching perspective, really my job is to just be as present as I can possibly be in any moment inside that conversation. And then whatever there is to say next, it'll be there. I don't plan it out ahead of time. Just like if I'm up on stage and I'm playing and singing, whatever is about to come out of my mouth next just comes out, as long as I'm not thinking about it. If I start thinking about it too hard, then I start screwing up.
Yeah, I think also one of the big changes of business was the rise of the HR department, which, you know, is one of the most hated parts of an organization. I mean, I don't think even the people who work in it are that fond of themselves. You know, it's probably the only department which doesn't have a department Christmas party because they can't stand the sight of each other. But, you know, it's become very difficult to advise businesses now because there's so many external factors, such as kind of operating in an ethical or green environment, that it's not just now worrying about the company itself, its building, its business and its internal stuff. You have to take so much into account. And obviously over the last year or two, with the rise of cancel culture and even big businesses becoming victims of making public statements, have you had to change your approach in the way that, you know, as a business coach, how you advise people, the advice you give to people, with something which wouldn't have been damaging maybe 10 years ago, can now actually play a big part affecting the performance of a business in the public eye?
I don't think so. I think it really comes down to integrity. So if, first of all, I think anybody who works with me, mostly the only way we got that far is that there's some kind of connection there. Whatever I say to them is making sense in some way. And for the most part, I've never really dealt with anybody who was doing things, you know, that were highly inappropriate or anything. So I haven't really had to deal with that. And when I'm working with smaller organizations, it's one of the reasons I don't want to work in the corporate environment so much or with really large teams. Because there's actually, I think, a lot more of issues to deal with and a lot of the kinds that you're talking about. In small business, to me, it seems more like keeping the wheels on and really learning to communicate super effectively, both with your team, if you have one, with your vendors, with your customers, all of that. And if anything, I think that's become the challenge because there's too many darn ways to communicate now. And people like to take shortcuts. You know, hammer on people who try to do business with a text message. Stop it. You know, a text message is great if you're telling me, hey, I'm running 5 minutes late, or hey, can you meet me at 5 o'clock? But don't try to have an actual conversation like that in business. I don't know what you're doing. I don't know what you're talking about. Email's only a little bit better. It's a little better. But, you know, let's actually have a conversation, you know? whenever possible. It's just so easy to avoid that now.
Right. Beautiful segue. It's almost like you knew exactly what I was going to ask you next. You know, Tristan was talking about the cancel culture and all that of the past couple of years. But, I mean, elephant in the room, let's talk about COVID, right? So all of a sudden COVID comes March of 2020 and we all throw our hands up in the air, run and buy all the toilet paper we can find and change the way we've done business. So how have you been coaching your businesses that you're working with through COVID?
You know, it's interesting. I don't have a single client whose business actually suffered during COVID. My business probably did worse than any of theirs because the music side of my business went kaput, right? The coaching side was fine. The music side of my business went, you know, I did nothing. I went from playing 80 to 100 dates a year to playing, I think in 2020, I played three times in the same person's backyard. That was it, at least after March. And this year, honestly, I haven't done that much more. So I don't know if I have a good answer to the question. I think the hard part has been just navigating the emotional ramifications of all of it and trying to keep the wheels on and keep doing what you do, even though there's a lot of weird stuff going on.
Do you think the face of communication between bosses and their staff is going to be forever changed because of this? Because, you know, some companies obviously realized they didn't need a physical workspace. And right. I guess just because of tradition, they had kept with that. And COVID forced a lot of people into this model where you're going to have remote workers. Otherwise, the business just doesn't operate and shuts down. But, you know, it's a little bit different for a boss to impose their will when somebody's physically there, when you can keep an eye on somebody, check on somebody, and, you know, body language comes into play, tone of voice. But like you were alluding to, you know, between text and email, so much gets lost in translation. When people read between the lines, it's like you said, it can almost mean anything, you know, right, when you receive a text. So do you think that's going to change in terms of your approach to business coaching, that you're now going to have to teach coaches how to manage in a remote style, perhaps develop a new style of management, you know, remote management, because it's going to be relevant to so many more people than it used to be before? I mean, is coaching for you going to take on that extra little bit of, you know, preparation for bosses that perhaps they didn't used to have to worry about?
It might. You know, I think it really all comes down to one very simple word, and I've had a number of conversations about this just today, which is, and it sounds like I'm being too simple, but it really is just communication. You know, we're terrible communicators by and large. We really are. We're lazy. We're sloppy. Well, I think you know what I'm talking about, and you really don't, nor should you have any reason to. If we're dealing with people that we work with all the time, we automatically make all kinds of assumptions about what we think they know. And oftentimes they don't. You know, so I might send you an email and ask you a question and you look at it and you think about answering that, but you don't answer it. And maybe I had a timeline, like I needed to know, but I didn't put that in the email because I just figured you'd see it and you'd answer my question. But I wasn't really thinking about the fact that you were busy and your kid was yelling at you from the other room and, you know, you had 100 things going on and the dog just peed on the rug and whatever else was going on, right? So you don't answer me. And then it gets lost in the, you know, in the inbox from heck. And then I don't hear from you. And then I start making up, oh, you know, I don't even think Max likes me. You know, the last time I talked to him, he was pretty short with me. You know, I don't know what's going on. And then I start getting pissed. And you see where this is going, right? When all I had to do was be a little more explicit with you and ask the question and say, hey, you know, I need you to get back to me by X, you know, like tomorrow at noon. And then let's say you didn't because the dog peed on the rug and your kid came in and you forgot. I would know that I have to follow up with you. So I'd follow up. I'd say, hey, did you get my email? Oh, yeah, you know, here's your answer. Am I making sense?
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. It kind of reminded me of a comment I made to some people. There's a guy with a company that I work with, and he had emailed me something from another guy and says, I don't understand what he wants. And so I read the email. I'm like, yeah, I speak Tommy. And so the guy's name's Tommy. And so if he would have sent it to me, I would have known exactly what Tommy wanted because I speak Tommy. And so I had to explain it to the other guy that forwarded it to me. I'm like, no, this is what he wants and blah, blah, blah. Beautiful kind of segue into that communication that you're talking about. Is that that biggest struggle that businesses are having now? And how do you work with somebody to get them to communicate better?
I think it's a struggle for all businesses and probably all people all the time. I mean, think about your relationships that don't work. People don't communicate, right? They don't talk about, you know, real things. In business, I think it's super hard, but communication is a skill. It's not just something that you're born with. You know, maybe you're born with more aptitude towards, but it's a learnable skill. It really is. I think you have to be able to see where it doesn't work. Awareness always comes first. If you can't see it, you can't change it. So if you can become aware of the holes of what's missing in communication, finding resources to figure out how to get better at it, that's not the hard part. It's really just being able to see, oh, wait a minute. That's actually coming from me. I'm not communicating well. And people don't want to be responsible for that either. They always want to blame it on the other guy. Oh, well, I sent him an email, you know. Well, yeah, but he doesn't know what you want, right?
Right. But would you not agree, though, that some people are kind of born with that ability to communicate? And it's kind of interesting that you say it can be taught. I don't know if I agree with you on that, because there are so many people, it's like you're saying, you know, you got to put in this email that there's a timeline required and you left that out or whatever. Right. And it's like trying to teach the dog not to pee on the carpet. And then eventually the dog just says, you know what, I'm going to do what I want to do. Do you run into those problems where it's like, you know, you say you can teach that, but there are some people that are just flat out unteachable?
Well, there's some people who just flat out don't want to learn.
That as well, yeah.
Are they unteachable? I doubt it. Because really, that same person, if they really wanted to learn that, if they were like, look, I can see how this is making my life miserable, they would figure it out. They would. And the reason that I hammer on that it's teachable is because I've learned to be better at it. And yeah, maybe, I don't know, maybe I have an aptitude for it, because even when I was a kid, I talked till I was blue in the face. I'm getting paid back for that because my own child never, ever stops talking. But I know that I've been able to get better at it. Do I have it licked? No, absolutely not. I can always grow. And maybe it comes down to that. Are you a growth person, or are you a I'm good where I'm at person?
Right. Now, about 5 years ago, you started Artist Mind Inc. A couple of questions. Where does the name come from? And secondly, what do you think are the unique challenges smaller business owners face as opposed to larger corporations? You know, from a personal experience, I can say, going back to being a business analyst, it was mainly financial in nature, in terms of telling people where to stop wasting money and where to redirect money. And that would solve a lot of issues. But, you know, that obviously that's like 25 years ago now, and I'm sure the business environment has changed a lot, and I've had very little to do with it to that depth anymore. But yeah, just going back to that, where did the name come from, and what are the challenges you see, especially now coming out of COVID, hopefully? You know, what are the biggest challenges small businesses
coming
face?
Out of COVID? Look at you being so optimistic.
Well, we live in Texas. We've been coming out of COVID for over a year. That's right. It's everybody else having an issue with it.
What are you talking about?
Yes, Texas. We don't have COVID in Texas.
No. What is COVID?
What do you mean? I don't know. It's funny that you ask about the name. It's not the first name that I had for whatever my company is. I was just trying to think, how do I come up with something that encompasses all the things that I do? Because Artist Mind kind of becomes the umbrella, you know, for everything I'm up to. And that's really it. There was nothing particular about it. I thought, well, I'm an artist, and I deal a lot and almost exclusively what's going with my clients in what's going on in their heads. And that's something I'm highly, highly interested in. As far as, I think it's really funny that you said that you dealt with people as an analyst, and I totally would get this on, you know, where they're wasting money and how they're allocating that. And, you know, maybe it's different now. It's not. It's not any different now. You know, the biggest challenge to having a business, and I'm not sure it matters what size it is people. You know, people. People are wonderful and they're awful and they're smart and they're stupid. And the only thing that's ever gotten in my way is me. And that's true of everyone I've ever worked with and every business I've ever worked with. The thing that makes it great is the people, and the things, and the thing that makes it not work at all is the people. So it's really, the challenge is the people. The challenge is finding the ways that a business owner actually impedes their own success. And hopefully they're able to see that and create some new habits and behaviors and change the way they're looking at things so that they can do better.
So going along those same lines with the people, right? I've read some news stories and they call it the Great Resignation. You know, people are quitting their jobs, yeah, or early retirement, things like that, in an unprecedented percentage rate, or however you want to describe that, right?
Yeah.
In your coaching some of your businesses and going through all that, what's your take on this Great Resignation? Like, what's going on? Yeah. Do we stop it? Can we stop it? Should we stop it?
Yeah, it's really weird. Like, do you guys have this up there where you go out to eat and nobody has any?
Yeah. We went, not him and I, but I took the wife to a chain restaurant on the border. And this was like, I don't know, like 2 weeks ago. And we pulled up and there were four other cars that pulled up almost at the same time. So everybody kind of gets out of the car at the same time. And now there's a line to get in, right? And so we don't really think about it too much. It's like, hey, everybody pulled up at the same time, so they're just trying to catch up. Well, then we just kept standing there. And so I told the wife, I'm like, go find out what's going on. So she kind of meanders through there and comes back, and she said, they have one waiter for the whole restaurant.
Yeah.
And I said, nope. So we went next door to Fuzzy Tacos, walked up to the line, served ourselves, and had some good tacos.
Oh, man, I love some Fuzzies. I haven't had Fuzzies in a while.
Yeah. By the way, Fuzzy Taco, we do not have an official taco sponsor. So if you would like to sponsor the podcast, we would be open to that.
Yeah. Oh, Fuzzy Taco, you got to do it.
Mm. Yeah.
Come on, sponsor the Wolf and the Shepherd. Do it.
Yeah. There we go. But going back to that Great Resignation, you know, what's your take?
Well, I'm going to answer your question, but I wanted to tell you that I did sing a jingle for On the Border Cafe in the 90s.
Oh, did you?
Cool.
well, and by the way, I'm not dogging On the Border. No. I mean, it's good food, and it's not their fault.
If they want to sponsor us, we will happily eat there free every day and have a video clip of it.
Right.
Yeah.
It's really weird. I've asked a bunch of people that same question, like, what do you think is actually going on? Because I don't know what to think about it. I know that my clients can't hire anybody. They can't find anybody to work. Any of my people who are trying to hire somebody are finding it even more difficult than they did before. It's always challenging, but they're finding it super challenging. I don't know. Maybe there's a lot of factors. I like to think that in some industries, people got a little taste of not grinding themselves into a pulp for work and went, I'm not going to do this anymore. I don't know what they're doing. That's the thing that I can't figure out. All right, so there's nobody working at all the restaurants. All right, well, I kind of get that because most people move on from a restaurant job. You know, you do a lot of that as a server sometimes when you're younger, and maybe you move on. Maybe a bunch of those people went, you know, I'm going to go do whatever it was I really wanted to do. Or they went back to school or they did whatever. But what are people doing? I don't know.
So
I find it very confusing.
Yeah, but I have a theory on this.
Oh,
so,
do tell.
Yeah. So a couple of days ago, the wife and I go out to eat, and we go to a pizza place. And it's a little pizzeria in Roanoke, Texas. And we walk in, and they had a fair amount of staff in there, right? They had three or four waiters, but it's a smaller place. It's much smaller than on the border. And when we were leaving, there was a restaurant across the street that had a sign saying temporarily closed. And my wife said, well, you know, they must not be able to hire staff. And I said, I think I've figured out why nobody wants to work in restaurants anymore. And it has nothing to do with the $2.13 plus tips and anything. I said, all you have to do is look at our boys and realize why nobody wants to work. And she said, well, what do you mean? I said, our kids want an Xbox, and they have that. They want a phone, and they've got that. And that's all they want. It's not true. Like back in our day where, you know, we went and spent $20 on a CD, right? They just stream the music. They watch all the content they want. They don't really care to even go to the movies or anything. They've got a bajillion channels on Netflix and Hulu and YouTube and everything. And they've got their phones. They can communicate. They don't even want to go anywhere. So why work?
My son told me that the Netflix is free. I said, it's free for you.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you got mom and dad paying those little bills, right?
Right.
Why work? You got everything you want. So that's my theory.
Yeah. I mean, I think
probably not far off.
I mean, I think that, you know, despite our consciousness, man is still pretty much chemotropic in terms of, you know, what drives us. And so obviously people can economically cope at the moment with taking a little vacation away from work, or perhaps going from two working people in the family to one working person. But certainly economically, if the country kind of keeps going the direction it's been trending towards over the last few months, that sooner or later, that's not going to be a position, you know, most families and most people can, you know, take anymore, especially once, you know, all the kind of COVID grants and benefits run out and the, you know, costs of goods, services rising. How are people going to get back into a moving workplace when perhaps there's been so many changes that they're actually not a fit for what they were before? You know, even those people who have been working, their job is very different now in a lot of ways than it perhaps was a year and a half, 2 years ago. But when you've got somebody who's taken out of the system and then tries to jump back in, you know, they're going to be at somewhat a disadvantage because, you know, life goes on, business goes on. And I know quite a few friends who have their own businesses, and their channels of distribution have changed greatly over this last 18 months. The way they communicate with customers, you know, everything's changed. Do you think when this workforce after its break tries to go back in, there's going to be issues in how they integrate into this new society?
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. You know, it's interesting. I think, and it's so industry dependent, it's also different. I wonder, and maybe I'm more of a cockeyed optimist than anything else. I like to think that all of the craziness from the last couple of years, you know, from, you know, the last election cycle through COVID, through all of it, all the division, all of the, you know, just all of it. I'd like to think that when that workforce comes back, as all of it starts to grow again, that maybe employers and employees will see each other differently. That maybe employers will say, wow, I'm actually really glad I have people showing up. What can I do to have them thrive in this job. Because when an employee thrives in their job, the business thrives. And oftentimes, and this may be true of more, you know, larger organizations, it can be hard to manage that. It can be hard to put the things in place for that. I hope that all of this, that this period of time maybe makes a few more people, a few more employers think, wow, you know, it's great to actually have people who want to show up to work. How can I make them love what they're doing?
Right. It's kind of like when you tell your kid, you know, eat your dinner and enjoy it because there's starving kids in Africa. And, you know, that's what my parents always said. Yeah.
Stick it's it like, in an envelope and send it to them then.
Right. Yes, exactly. That's what I used to say as well. Now, if you were kind of, I'm going to use the metaphor, kind of stuck in an elevator with a business owner and you had like 5 minutes, I don't want to divulge all of your stuff that you talk about, because obviously we'd like business owners and everything to, you know, get some coaching sessions from you. But if you had like one thing that you could say, whether or not you know they're doing it or not, what would that number one, like important, you know, quick thing you could tell a business owner they need to be doing?
Well, here's the question I ask every business owner. Where do you want to be in 5 years? Nobody's ever answered me. They all go, huh? Some version of, huh? So when I get, huh, I say, okay, great. I think you should figure that out. Because right now, you're sitting at a restaurant hoping somebody's going to bring you something you like.
Yeah, well, let's be honest. If you would have asked somebody that in 2016, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And no one would have got it right.
Well, I just mean, you know, where you want your business to go. And you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Now, like most people, I'd be quite happy if robots took over a lot of stuff. And
except security work in malls.
Well,
we've already discussed that. Yeah, they're not cut out for that.
Emotionally can't cope with it. Now, a lot of workforces, you know, can be, once they're remote and you take away that personal interaction, it's not too great of a leap to move towards that automation through AI, et cetera, where companies realize, you know what, perhaps we don't need people. We just need task management, tasks to be done. And now I'm not having to pay for this office space, whatever. I can invest more money in technology and actually having an effective workplace and some AI representation online, which takes the place of great Aunt Tabitha, who's 63 over there and has been with the company since she left kindergarten. Do you think that it's going to be more and more difficult, you know, for people to get involved into a career as such when you don't know if what you envisaged as a career is going to completely disappear within 3 or 4 years? It's going to be, you know, replaced by AI, or it's going to be split and fragmented into so many different bits. It's not going to be a one person job anymore. Everything's going to be outsourced to things which perform it kind of perfectly.
I think there's two different parts to that. And one of them, I heard a great interview with an AI, like a real AI scientist guy, who basically said, first of all, AI is nowhere near ready to do any of the stuff that we're afraid that it may someday do. And then mostly it's not meant to be a replacement for humans. It's meant to be an enhancement. I will say that interview made me feel a lot better about all of it. I don't think in 3 or 4 years, robots or AI or anything else is going to replace that many people doing anything. Because even in task-oriented, let's say in an automotive plant, yes, they have robot arms that do things, but they also need people to maintain all those robot arms. So yeah, the guy who used to, you know, put all the screws into the door, he needs to learn how to do this other thing now, and can absolutely be trained at how to do that. So I think the jobs are going to change without question. But you said the word outsource.
Yeah, because there are a lot of things done by a lot of different people Yes. Which, if you put all that together, you're going to come out with a more effective result than 20 different people doing it. But the problem is one person can only think so much and do so much work by themselves. But when you have a, you know, an algorithm which can take all of these components together and come out with a better response, I mean, kind of look at the, perhaps the decision making, you know, like a lot of staff don't have that much decision making outside of should I turn up for work, should I leave early, you know, they just follow the instructions they're given. But you do have people, especially in small companies, where, you know, perhaps everybody has a level of responsibility within that company. But sure, just as you've seen, you know, a lot of smaller companies who used to have receptionists now have automated systems, just yes, and it came out of necessity and finances, you know, get rid of the secretary because it saves us money. You know, it doesn't take any time off sick, hopefully. And, you know, that's great. So, I mean, those type of jobs where you can see it's an easy step to automation. Mm-hmm. It's an easy step that even if the AI isn't quite as personable and it doesn't seem that businesses care too much about that anymore, that, you know, this great resignation, a lot of those people are not going to have jobs to go back to eventually. You know, they are
going to same job.
Yeah, they are going to have to take this time to learn new skills, get a new skill set, you know, as you mentioned. And, you know, I think that, you know, if people perhaps over the age of 40, you know, think they're going to be able to skate by with limited IT knowledge, thinking, all right, I'm 20 years, 25 years from retiring, I think they're going to come in for a big shock. Because probably over the next 5 years, we're going to see a lot more things move towards being managed by IT, maybe in cohorts with humans. But I think IT decision making is certainly going to come in a lot more.
Yeah, but
I think you're right.
Going along with that, though, doesn't that almost kill that quote unquote entry level job? You know, you always hear about, oh, the kid that started in the mailroom and then he gets moved to here and moved to there. Well, when you automate the mailroom, you can't put a kid in the mailroom. And so now he's got to start here and so on and so forth. And you automate all those entry level jobs. So how are people supposed to even get the experience?
I think it changes the entry level job. Somebody's got to write the automation. The entry level job becomes an entry level coder, which your kids probably already know how to do, that they're doing it on their Xbox right now. You don't even know. You probably go home and they'll be able to turn the lights on and start your car with the Xbox because they know how to do that stuff. I'm not sure how it'll for sure change what jobs are available. Absolutely. And it'd be interesting to see if as a culture where we actually at any point become interested in training people to do, you know, these things that are going to be necessary in the future. I don't know. It's funny. I was trying to think when you gave that example about the secretary, you know, how there used to be a secretary and you get rid of the secretary and you know, use an automated thing. And all the small businesses I've ever worked with, yeah, I always try to get them to automate their phone answering because they never had a secretary and it's the business owner answering their own cell phone all the time. And I'm like, you have to stop doing that. So we find them a way to automate it, which is fantastic because they can't afford to hire somebody to do that.
But so you're the guy responsible for the every time I call something, I have to wait and hear that pre-recorded message and push one. And then I have to say, talk to a person, talk to a person, talk to a person. Yeah. That's all your fault. Okay.
Yes, it's my fault. And I have also yelled at the phone, talk to a freaking representative. You know, many times. Yeah,
I've actually watched him do that when the clear instruction, because he's had it on speakerphone, the clear instruction is press zero, but he still shouts at it.
It's just, it's more fun that way.
Oh, yeah, it makes me angry. But I do know a workaround, by the way, especially in Texas, and this is probably nationwide. Do you know the quickest way to actually get to a person in one of those automated things?
No, but this will make the whole episode better. Yep. Go ahead.
So all you have to do is know just a little bit of Spanish. You need to be able to count to 10 in Spanish. And you listen whenever it says, para continuar en español, marque cinco. And you're like, oh, five. So you always go on the Spanish one because once you do that, it's bilingual representatives there and it's a shorter wait time. So then they answer in Spanish and you say, oh, I'm sorry, I must have hit the Spanish button. They're like, oh, that's okay, I speak English, what can I do for you? Works every time.
You are a freaking genius. That's all there is to it.
So on that note, now he's solved like a huge issue. Is this going to free up more time for you to kind of like continue on with the music career? Because one thing I did want to ask you,
I single-handedly just put you out of business.
Well, no, this is the thing now. Now he can advise people with his secret knowledge and they'll be like, oh my goodness, this is game-changing. I'm so glad I paid him $1,000 for that. Now he can retire quicker.
I'm raising my rates.
Well, not only that, but think about how much time you're saving all these businesses by just, pay me $1,000. I'm going to show you how to save 2 hours out of your day. And you just send that on a little note card and make checks payable to Bill Small and you're done.
That sounds like a program that comes up on your Facebook feed, Save hours of time. Pay me $2,000.
Right. So I wanted to cycle back to music before we kind of finish today, because obviously it's a huge part of your life. And, I don't know whether you deliberately balanced it with a career or whether you needed to balance it with a career. And by career, I mean in business, because, obviously music can be a career. But
they call it a day job.
Yeah. If music was an option where you could be 100% bankrolled with it, would you kind of give up all the business stuff and just concentrate on the music? Or do you think the business thing kind of keeps you balanced and grounded a little bit and allows you to keep music as enjoyable and not a job as such?
Yeah, so that's all I did for a long time. I made my entire living through music and musical pursuits for a very long time. I didn't plan to do what I'm doing. It just kind of happened. And I'm really happy about it. You just said something, one of the byproducts is that it did take the pressure off of music. So it wasn't the thing I had to do to make money, which made it a whole lot more fun for me. But I don't like doing just one thing. So, even in music, if I was only playing with a band, then I'd really want to go play by myself. And if I'm only playing gigs by myself, then I can't wait to play with a band. And this is just a larger version of that. I like to be involved in lots of different things. I'm glad you guys are in Fort Worth. I've spent a pretty enormous amount of time playing music in Fort Worth. Our little band, Walt Wilkins and the Mystic Arrows, we did pretty well up there. Had a nice little following that would come to our shows. And
now, what type of music do you play?
Well, that band was considered, kind of country rock, Texas music sort of stuff. I don't know if you know or have heard of Walt. He's a really wonderful songwriter. I actually heard him for the first time in Nashville when we were all living there. I lived there for about 3 years. He lived there for a long time. Never imagined that we'd end up working together, and we all moved back to Texas about the same time and ended up in a band together. But he wrote some songs that a guy named Pat Green put on a few records, and those songs became kind of well known, and that made Walt pretty well known around Texas. So that kind of helped us get a little traction in the state of Texas. And for almost 16 years, we traveled all over the state and a bunch of other places in the country and the world. You ever been to a place up there called Shipping and Receiving? You know that bar?
No. But
you guys need to get out more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was actually going to ask you, where was your favorite place to play in Fort Worth? I'm going to guess the answer is Shipping and Receiving.
No, my favorite place to play is no longer there. It was called the Live Oak. It was absolutely fantastic.
Where was that at?
A great little place. And I knew you were going to ask me that, and I knew I would fail miserably this part of the test. What is that area, the kind of artsy,
like area, the 7th Street area, or Camp Bowie area?
More like, is it on the east side or the south side, something like that? I'll know it when I hear it.
Yeah, I know. After anyway, we're all done here, it's going to hit us like a ton of bricks.
Yeah, of course it will.
Are you talking about the area like where the Aardvark was and the Rec Room?
No, there are not a whole lot of other venues over there.
Gotcha. I'm at a loss. I was thinking about, you know, places like that, Ridgely Theater, you know, some of those old, like back in the 90s, you know, music clubs and everything. Fort Worth had a big scene back then. I mean, the Toadies came from Fort Worth and they played in all those clubs.
Absolutely. It was over, I'm looking it up.
Yeah, no, go ahead. It's driving me nuts too, because I hadn't heard of it, the Live Oak, but I'm so trying to...
I always forget what the neighborhood is called. It's like 8th and Rosedale and Main Street and over by Baylor Scott and White.
Oh, yeah.
Children's
it,
Medical
you know,
Center.
Kind of, it, well, I call it the hospital district, but it, you know, because that's where all the hospitals in Fort Worth are. But I know exactly where you're talking about.
Yeah, over there.
Cool. Hey, Bill, thanks so much for joining us today. Can you let everybody know how they can find out more about you, you know, social media, your website, music, all that good stuff for us?
Yeah, you betcha. So you asked about Artist Mind. You can always find me at artistmind.co. That's primarily kind of coaching stuff. If you want to know more about music, billsmallmusic.com. How easy is that? And then easy to find on Facebook, just my name, Bill Small. Or if you're into Instagram, which I don't know if I am or not. I mean, I have one.
Yeah. I hear you there. We have one too, and we always forget to put stuff on it. So
yeah, it's at MindArtCoach. But
very good.
Yeah, those are the places you can find me.
Well, we appreciate it, Bill. Thanks so much for joining us, and that will do it for this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd, and we will catch you on the next
one. Thank you, man.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd podcast. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, thewolfandtheshepherd.com, to your friends and colleagues. And please leave us a positive review on iTunes when you get a chance. Check us out on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for additional content. Join us next time for another episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd.